Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is, or actually, let me just say this. I always start my shows off with what we would call, what I call the obligatories, or what I would look at as the no-brainers. I think when I say it's now or never, most Americans should start understanding that. If they understand the context of the show, this is not a show for entertainment. This is not a show to go over the news. This is not a show that, in some ways, I consider it entertainment, but there are lots of people who dive into, and they're just the conspiracies and the all other things out there. This show, under the premise that I've always tried to function by, as soon as I heard this little adage, reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. So it is imperative for us to unite. We have to start agreeing on things. The only way we're going to get there is to get equally informed, which is why I constantly go through content here. If you read the same documents that we read, and we go through these things, these are all founding documents. There are all sorts of other documents that may be fascinating, may be interesting, may even give you an understanding of where things went wrong. But that's not important. If we're going to save this republic, we have to make choices. If we're going to actually preserve our liberty and not fall into the arms of global communism, we have to act. And we have to unite, so we have to get reasonably informed, reasonable people equally informed. So we need to get equally informed. And I believe the people in America, most people in America, are reasonable. What is unreasonable is this concept that you don't have time to get informed. I tell you what, if you don't have time to get informed, you won't have time to be oppressed. If you think taking time to get informed and getting involved is just going to be too much of a burden for you, wait till we get oppressed. Wait till everything goes south. Now, most people will, they have no clue as to what's going to happen. And as a matter of fact, I had this conversation today, and I brought up Thomas Sowell's Intellectuals in Society, his book, Intellectuals in Society, and how these post-World War I Jewish educators convinced the people of France that it was best to basically help people come to the conclusion that instead of fighting, because the French took such a bloody toll from World War I, that they convinced everybody that it would be better to just placate whoever comes in to invade them so that they don't die. And so that they could all, this is a survival mode. Let's just conform. Let's be conformists. And so when World War II kicked off and Hitler came in, this is historical. This is a standard process of tyranny, oppression. When you get taken over, they get rid of everybody who they believe is an enemy. These two Jews were one of the first two people to get killed, to be round up and killed. Because people with education, people with status, affluence, or influence are a threat. If you're a threat, you will be gotten rid of. Even though you may have been instrumental in kind of helping the success of the being overtaken, they don't care. They have too many people. The fact of the matter is, there are too many people. They're already doing everything they can to kill as many of us as we possibly can. Now, so there's all sorts of people out there that, as far as I'm concerned, they're a complete waste of time. And as I look at those people who are exposing all of the evil things that they're doing, they are a part of the problem. Because I get pulled in, and as a matter of fact, I had this conversation regarding Catherine Austin Fitz. Wow, she's showing us all of these terrible things. and how they're going, you know, what they're doing and how they're protecting themselves. So what does that matter? Why are those things so important to you? You would think that, you know, getting your hands on the key, getting that key into the lock and opening that, you know, unlocking that door, opening the door and getting to the side of safety would be more important than watching, you know, all of these aspects happening around you of how they're going to destroy you. Do you really need to know? Or would you rather know what it takes to stop them? Would you rather stop them, regardless of all of their investments, regardless of what they have done, would you rather stop them and succeed in preserving your liberty and preserving this life that our forefathers basically created for us by the divine inspiration of the divine hand of providence? Anyway, so I have these obligatories. I don't want to dive into them and what they all mean if you don't understand, because as far as I'm concerned, these are no-brainers. It's now or never, folks. When you look at the debt, that debt is fraud. When you look at the conspiracies and all of these things, who cares if they're true? It has nothing to do with the solution. When you look at, you know, what's happening, the winds, and so it does not have anything to do with the solution. The only thing that matters are the winning in the ground level of demanding compliance of the Constitution. The only path we need to be on is demanding compliance of the Constitution. Anybody that takes you down a path of complacency and or placating and or compromise, anybody that says, well, we don't want to come across intolerant. We don't want to come across harsh. You know, let's not put demanding compliance of the Constitution now. Let's just start educating people and getting them on board with us. If you're not up front with where you are right now in demanding compliance of the Constitution so that people completely understand why it is paramount, why we all have to be demanding compliance of the Constitution, and you're going down a different path, you're not a part of the solution. You're a part of the problem. When we look at all of these, we've gone through the paths. We have covered the paths. The court is not the solution. The party right now is not the solution. We have to take back, we have to take back the party and correct it. We have to do what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison did. And I'm telling you what, there are plenty of people that, you know, because they feel the need of having other people included, and then when that happens, they have to placate those people. Oh, well, you know, I'm not going to do anything unless you carry our little torch of our agenda, whether it's demographics, whatever. That is the dangerous path to take, because you're not being taken to the path of the solution. You're never going to get there that way. You're just going to meander through and feel like you're doing good things because you're now working with people. You know what? If America can't start waking up, this is why I'm making a lot of harsh efforts to focus on content. So back through the appeal to heaven and the obligatories. We all have to appeal to heaven. We all need to start getting on our knees. But in doing so, we better start learning on what is important, learning what was created. You can't save something. You can't save a capitalistic market. You can't save an open free market with regulations. You have to remove regulations. You have to basically create or get back to a free market. And when we look at how government has basically taken our free market and regulated it and created a mercantile market system, how do you get back to that? You have to undo all of those regulations to get back to a free market. Now, when I say a free market within the United States, not a free market with the world. The framers never wanted a free market with the world. They wanted to encourage, you know, reciprocating benefits with other nations. But it was clear that other nations serve themselves as we need to serve ourselves and our interests. Every nation, just like every individual, has their own interests. And every nation, like every individual, has a right to defend their interests. These are all fundamental premises that the framers understood. The other obligatories is literally getting everybody to understand the importance of constitutional compliance. That is why we basically lay this out, that, you know, why the DOJ easily, if Trump really cared about fixing this country, he would be actually going towards constitutional compliance instead of his own agenda. And it is becoming more and more apparent that it's all about the agenda than it is compliance. The fact that he continually fights with the courts on the same, at the level that the courts want him to fight at, when he has the ability to enforce the Constitution and drag all of those judges out of court, remove them, if they don't support the Constitution. I'm going to just go here real quick because we'll dive into this when I get into the things that are going on either Monday or Friday next week. The fact that he is playing these legal games with the Supreme Court over the repelling of invaders, kicking invaders out of America, to me, as far as I'm concerned, he's doing the wrong thing. He is playing their game, and it's a dangerous game that they play. When it comes down to somebody that's here that is not here with proper authorization, they are an invader. The Constitution calls them an invader. You don't have to be a military force to be an invader. That's why they actually used and changed the language in the Constitution to invaders. And that's exactly why in Article 1, Section 8, they can call the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. We have an invasion, and you can start kicking all of these people out because actually the federal government has been participating in the invasion because they've been bringing refugees here. They don't have the authority to do that. They don't even have the authority over immigration. Everybody has become a part of the problem because the states have become a part of the problem, the federal government. And I can prove all of these things when we dive academically into this, and I have already. If you've been listening to the show, then you know that I'll leave it there. We'll dive into this on Friday, probably, if not Monday, because I've got content to get into. I want to focus on that. So as we kind of go down this path of the obligatories, it's all about constitutional compliance. And it's the same thing regarding my presidential campaign. I'll be happy to run, but I'm not going to run by the party system. We have to dismantle the party stranglehold that they have on access to our public services. For public servants to actually get into office, there's no constitutionality to allowing the party to control access. It is unconscionable that they've done that. So, as we move forward, we're going through what I would say is the states, nationalists, the sovereign citizens, this menage of this amalgamation of documents that they're using as the epiphany of how the Constitution is illegitimate and that we need to go back to the Articles of Confederation. They've done nothing to actually prove their case. And what they've done is they've given you so much information that they know nobody's going to read it. But we have read every document on this, and there is no there. As a matter of fact, all of the evidence proves that the states actually recognized that the Articles of Confederation were failed. The states and the people of the states collectively recognized and agreed to ratify the Constitution and move forward with a limited and defined federal government, granting the states all residual powers left to them and the people. So, what we have now, we're at the point where on this document, if you've downloaded it, you're more than welcome to kind of go through what they created. And we're finally at the point of the Utah Enabling Act. I think it's a disservice. And one of the things I have to do as a part of content, as far as making sure that you understand this part of the Constitution, and the part of the Constitution we're dealing with is Article 4, Section 3, the admission of new states into the Union. So I would not be honest, and I'd be disingenuous if I did not give you some historical points of reference regarding enabling acts. So the best point is the very first state joining the Union. When we look at the very first state joining the Union, and we've already gone through Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, they all agreed that there should be no diminishment of sovereignty, that if a new state joins the Union, they should enjoy the same level of sovereignty that every state in the Union has. So in Article 4, Section 3, they clearly gave the federal government no ability to diminish any sovereignty over a state. When you read it there, they have the authority to create needful rules and regulations respecting the territory. When that state is admitted into the Union, that state has the right of self-determination, and they have the right of deciding what they want to do. If they want to actually, if the state wants to take full control over its soil, in other words, if they're going to basically control a person's access to the mineral rights, to water in the soil, what have you, then it needs to be within that state constitution. Because clearly the United States Constitution, the federal constitution that we all look at as the original constitution, not this annotated constitution, we all see that the federal government had no ability to control mineral rights. Each state was to control their own. Whether they were controlling it or not, it was left to the people. Because as Madison says, constitutions are what controls government, and people are the ones that control constitutions. So the people will determine whether their government can do those things. Now, some of the states that joined the Union is a kind of an ancillary point to give you. Some of the states that joined the Union actually came in with parts of their constitution, or they had a clause in their constitution that basically said, you know, every 20 years we need to revisit whether we need to have a convention to examine the state constitution to determine if we need to change it, if there are problems with it. And New York has that clause. There are other states that have that clause. I think that's a good clause, but I think the problem is that the information why they do that and how they do that needed to be clarified. Because when the state of New York's constitution was originally done, it was done by delegation, not by democracy. Eventually, as they started changing, they actually allowed democracy to become the rule of the day in the state, because every other state was doing it. Why not? You know, because democracy allows, or actually makes, a very vulnerable government. Or I should say, when you're using democracy and controlling your government, you actually have you've created a very volatile government that allows it to go down very dangerous paths. To have a limited defined government and to keep it in check, to make sure it can't go down dangerous paths where it can actually start doing harm to minorities. Because when you've got the mob rule, the mob will rule in favor of the mob and in the disadvantage of the minority. And the way our governments were erected, the way the foundation was poured with the Declaration of Independence, was we needed to protect the minority. We needed to protect the individual and their rights. These are inalienable rights, as it was stated and clarified. Anyway, so let's get into the Vermont Enabling Act. Now, Vermont joined the Union, if I remember correctly. This was done in 1791. I think so. Let me go to my controlled states order in joining the Union, and yea, verily, March 4th, 1791 is when Vermont actually joined. So after 2 years of the federal government's in existence, Vermont joined the Union. So in other words, they finally figured out what and how and why. Now, I want you to, this, I'm going to be putting this up on my website on the academic source documents page. And so I want you to see how simplistic the admission of Vermont was to the Union. An act for the admission of the state of Vermont into this Union, and it was done so in Philadelphia. Congress of the United States at the third session begun and held at the city of Philadelphia on Monday, the 6th of December, 1790, an act for the admission of the state of Vermont into this union. Okay, so those are basically just titles. Here is the meat, and we're only talking about a very short paragraph. This is the meat of them joining. This is the requirements, the stipulations, whatever you want to call it. Here is them coming into the union, where Congress basically says, this is what you do. The state of Vermont, having petitioned the Congress to be admitted a member of the United States, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress, assembled, and it is hereby enacted and declared that on the fourth day of March, 1791, the said state, by the name and style of the State of Vermont, shall be received and admitted into this union as a new and entire member of the United States of America. Now, the Constitution, When we look at the Constitution, Article 4, Section 3, it clearly states the parameters of how the states are to be admitted into the Union. And so when we go down the path, let me pull it up, because I think it's more important to actually have it than not. And so let me get there, and I hate to do this. But as we look at, and I think I've got it already open. Let me hear you. You have color-coded right there. So I love my color-coded Constitution. Article 4, Section 3, this is how they're to join. So in other words, you notice in the Enabling Act that Congress didn't tell them to go create their Constitution. Congress didn't tell them how to form their state. This is what we call the right of self-determination. They get to determine what city they want to convene. They know best. Right? They don't know what the weather, the trends are. Maybe they do now, you know, with history and so forth, but it doesn't matter. Congress doesn't have the power in Article 4, Section 3 to tell them how to set up their state and government. Only that in Article 4, Section 4, the United States government guarantees to every state in the union, in other words, the guarantee is really a requirement, that each state adjoins to the union must be Republican in form. They left that kind of ambiguous to basically say, well, states can be the way they want to. You have to understand one thing. When the Constitution was being submitted to the states, they had to walk a very delicate line to ensure that they weren't telling states how to do their job. Had they done that, had they actually embossed in the Constitution that when you adjoin to the union, when you ratify this document, you, one, have to be Republican in form in this very specific manner. You have to be bicameral. If they actually went into the weeds of what they needed to do, then they would have rejected the Constitution. The states that are already formed would have pointed to those clauses and said, look, they're telling us how to do our job. They're telling us that we're not good enough the way we're formed. We have to do something better. What they did was they gave us the exemplar in the Constitution to actually have a better government. You have to have these checks and balances. Well, the states didn't want to imbue those things because nefarious people involved recognize that if you have checks and balances, you lose control. If you've got a cabal, why would you give up your cabal? You've already got the power. Which is one of the reasons why we saw states who were problematic in the very beginning with the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. All of the other states other than Kentucky and Virginia basically said, we don't want to be involved in holding the federal government accountable. We kind of like what they're doing. We like the path that they're on. At least that was the state legislatures. That wasn't necessarily the people. So when we examine what the people actually did, the people actually listened to Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and said, yeah, you know what? You're right. We don't like what they're doing because they're actually taking away our liberties, very, very specifically with the Alien and Sedition Acts. Therefore, they followed Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in supporting this new party called the Republican Party to take back their country. We have to become, just like I've been telling you, we have to become like that. We have to be those role models. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me get back to focusing on, one, the admitting of new states into the Union, what the Constitution says, and some of the wording within these clauses of the Constitution. Now, fundamentally, looking at the Constitution, the powers delegated to the federal government are found in Article 1, Section 8. When I say the federal government, the powers for the federal government to make laws are directly listed, or are only listed right there in Article 1, Section 8. And why? Why is it only? Because Article 1 is Congress. It doesn't include the president, and it doesn't include the court. The judges. Congress is the only entity out of the three branches. Congress is the only entity that has the authority to create law. Is there anywhere there within Article 1, Section 8 that empowers Congress to regulate and or create laws respecting the states, the state governments, what they do, and so forth? No, at none at all. When you go through what is listed in Article 1, Section 8, they have very specific powers that they can create a power respecting the establishment of post roads. They don't have the authority to build post roads. They don't have the authority delegated to them to create highway systems. They only have the authority to establish a post road to make sure that the state doesn't create circumstances that would not be favorable for the network of post roads that the federal government has to support. So in other words, the establishment of a post road or where post offices are to be and so forth is left to the federal government to ensure that they're placed in suitable areas that align with the other states so that they can create an efficient post office system. Now, when I use the word efficient, I know that that gets confused because when we look at USPS, most people say it's government. It's not to be efficient, but the alignment and the organization, they have the responsibility of organizing that. That's why they're the ones that establish the post roads. They don't build them. So when we look at Article 4, Section 3, this is not a power. This is a delegated responsibility to the government and or to states. Because if you look at Article 1, Section 2, it basically states some of these responsibilities. And technically, when you look at a person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime, this Article 1, Section 2, it's the second paragraph. When you look at that role and responsibility, whose role and responsibility is this? Is this a federal government responsibility, or is this a state role and responsibility? And I'll tell you that this is actually a state role and responsibility. So this is one of the reasons why we had to color this, as far as using the color-coded Constitution, we had to color this in a mechanism so that it establishes or it helps clarify that this is a role assigned to the states. A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime who shall flee from justice and be found in another state shall, on demand and the execution of the authority of the state from which it fled, be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime. So is that something the federal government does? No. This is something that the Constitution demands, that if one state demands their criminals back, then the other states have to give them up. So this is a state responsibility, that the government will make sure that the other states will comply. So when we look at these roles and responsibilities that are in Article 4, some of these are very specific to states. Some are specific to the federal government. And so pretty much Article 1, Section 2, those right there are standards and or responsibilities and roles for the states. When we look at Article 4, Section 3, this is a role and responsibility for the, not the federal government, but for the states as well. So, Article 4, Section 3 is a role and responsibility granted to Congress, because it starts off here. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this union. Does anybody else have the authority? Are they listing anybody that has this? Now, maybe that what that means is Congress can basically determine what the standards are based on these following rules. In other words, if you come to say, hey, we formed this territory into a state, we're not forming this territory out of another state, we're not adjoining territories from other states to be a part of our state, this is just a new territory, which is why they have the clarification that follows this. It says, new states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction. So here's the caveat. Here's the stipulation. This is why Congress says that they may admit them into the union as long as these qualifications are not being violated. That no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of another state, nor any state be formed by junction or two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress. So in other words, they're protecting the sovereignty of the state. The existing state can't be muddled into a divide without the state legislature. So in other words, if you want to split your state, you actually have to incentivize the state legislatures to allow you to break away. Because when they look at, and the way government looks at land and people, they look at that as their source of revenue. Because we've got a perverted government system that basically the people and the land are theirs and they use you as a revenue model instead of them there to serve you. So when we look at what it takes to actually incentivize that, that's a different story. It's a different time. The fact of the matter is, Congress, as long as the qualifications of a state being admitted into the union it conforms to these standards that we just read, then that state will be admitted. There's no other caveat there that says, oh, this state has these, let me go with Utah. You have a religious, affiliation, or your religious doctrine doesn't jive with, your Christian doctrine doesn't jive with the rest of Christianity. So we're not going to let you come into the state. Or we're going to create parameters for you that you can't do these things, like plural marriage. Does the federal government have the, because we're going to get into this with the Utah Enabling Act. Do they have anywhere here where they can create a rule and regulation to inflict upon the state? Well, let's look at the second clause, the second paragraph of Article 1, Section 3, the entire process of admitting new states into the union. So as long as this state that it's applying to be admitted into the union is not taking these boundaries, messing with the sovereignty of a state or other states, because if you do, you got to get the consent of those states. Once you get the consent of those states, then Congress's hands are tied. They'll have to admit you. So the Congress, in other words, when Congress created some of the parameters, they actually took latitude. to say you have to have this many people. Now, I think it only makes sense to say if you're going to have a state government, you need to have at least this many people to support the fundamental government that needs to be formed, because you're going to have to tax that government. And you can't create a government, like you can't have a county government with only 100 people. You can't afford to pay, unless those 100 people are the most rich, the richest billionaires in the world, then you can have your own sheriff. You could pay for this big bloated government because you have the money. But when you look at people going in and trying to create land, and they've got limited resources, you need to make sure that your tax base is large enough to be able to support the fundamental services, not these nice-to-have services like welfare and these other things. Things that should be actually operating within our constitutional republic, but at least having some representatives who can kind of create the laws of traffic and those types of things to help regulate a civil society to ensure that the people are being served, that their liberties are being protected. So you have to have a judge, you have to have a sheriff, you have to have an executive, and you have to have a legislative branch. So in other words, the sheriff works for the executive because the executive is about executing the laws. So you need to have the problem is we never created a formal executive because the Constitution didn't want to step on toes and make everybody say, oh, they're trying to reform us. They're trying to tell us, we don't know what we're doing. But the model of having three separate branches in government is the best check and balance you can have. Right now, we see how the courts have completely run amok because they've aggrandized themselves over everybody. They've put themselves in an ivory tower to rule us. And that's how they've been ruling us. Oh, well, you come to us, we're going to tell you what you have to do. And Trump is playing their game where they're exercising power they don't have. They can't redefine the Constitution. Getting back to admitting states into the Union, this is the other ancillary powers, or these are ancillary to this responsibility. In other words, they have a responsibility of admitting states, and to do so, this is what the states are granting them, that Congress shall have the power, now it says power, to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or property belonging to the United States. In other words, until it becomes a state, it's property that belongs to the United States. They have a stewardship to ensure that it is being properly primed to become an equal party to the Union. Does there anywhere in there that they say, well, they can go in there and they can create their own structures? Because when you look at the land that Congress has the role and responsibility to actually occupy, when that's in Article 1, Section 8, actually it's at the very bottom of Article 1, Section 8, then you will actually find that in Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall have the power to basically have, I'm sorry, Congress shall have the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the such district, not exceeding 10 miles, as may by concession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government. So in other words, they have the ability to have exclusive legislation over those things that they constitutionally possess. They have a constitutional possession over territories until it becomes a state. If they go out and purchase land, adjoining land, like they did with the Louisiana Territory, that becomes property of the Union. It's not federal government property so that they can amass riches. The only purpose of having the land is to actually bring more states into the Union so that we can have a stronger Union, because the states themselves are not property of the federal government. They are the parties. The federal government is property of the states. Everything the federal government has and everything that they do is for the good of the states, not the other way around. And so when we look at admitting states into the Union and going back to Article 4, Section 3, this line that says Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, doesn't mean that they have the authority here to amass property. If they had that authority, it would have been listed right there where I was going through Article 1, Section 8. And in Article 1, Section 8, they go and list the ability to possess the District of Columbia, and then to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the state legislatures. In other words, they have to purchase the land from the state legislatures, and these are the things that they can have that land for. In other words, they can't just come along and say, hey, can we have forests? Can we have these mountains? Can we have these mines? Can we possess and control the minerals under your feet? Because what's enumerated, these are the things that are enumerated that they can possess. They can't make up, oh, well, because the environment's not here, right? The minerals, there's nothing in here for minerals. It has to be enumerated. So when we look at what these things are, the consent, right? They have to get the consent of the state legislature and buy these things. These are the only things that the state legislatures can legitimately consent to for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. They just can't say, well, we want to have forests. We want to own your resources because we want to control them and regulate them. And that's how, because nobody understands the Constitution, that's how they've been able to bamboozle creating federal properties, federal parks, federal forests. And in other words, they're creating Sherwood Forests so that they can actually starve the states from the opportunities economically that are offered by the minerals under the, you know, under the people's feet, by the resources, the water, the forests, the ability to produce food. This is why the BLM is going through the heartland of America, buying and shutting down the growing of food in America. You can't tell me the federal government doesn't have a plan that is actually waging economic warfare. They're going to starve us. They're using all forms of different warfare tactics, folks, because they're exercising powers not delegated. They're getting away with this crap. So getting back to Article 4, Section 3, let me dive into this one more time. That Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or property belonging to the United States. So in other words, if we possess property, let's say Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico hasn't become a state. It should have become a state a long time ago. It hasn't become a state. And so they have the power to dispose of it. If Cuba comes along and says, we want to make Cuba part of ours, part of us, and make it a part of our society, and a collection of islands, the federal government has the ability to do that. But to do so, to hand it over to them, there better be a reimbursement of the investments and everything else that we put into it. Or they're not serving the union and the states. The whole point is to build a stronger union by admitting more and more states into the union. Why is this function even there? And I will tell you, it is the Creator's plan of establishing and preserving liberty on earth, because all people want liberty. They don't want rulers to tell them what they have to eat and whether they can live or not. They want to be able to have a self-determination. They want to be able to go down these paths of doing things for themselves. So the concept of being able to admit all states and any state into the union doesn't say anywhere here that it has to be within the latitudes and longitudes of these coordinates, such as North America. So they may admit states into the union that are in Europe, that are in South America. But to do so, there needs to be, cognitive processes to understand strategically what is in play here. And when you look at the limitations on the federal government, they'll need to make sure that these nations or these states that come into the union, not like Somalia. Somalia, if it's going to be admitted into the union, it needs really, serious consideration of what has to happen, because there's a government that can't sustain itself. There's a group of people that are living in a part of the world that there is no ability to sustain, feed themselves. They don't have enough land to feed all the people. They don't have the resources to, unless they get educated, like, look at Singapore. Singapore doesn't feed itself. They don't. But they're educated, they're involved in finance and technology and so forth, where they're a society that provides intellectual services, where they are capable of sustaining themselves. They pay their own bills. They never ask, they never put their hand out saying, you know, our people are starving. It's a sad day when people create and form a government that literally creates this, you know, oh, we... And when we look at these governments that go down and these power brokers and cabals that actually want to have people suffer like that because they don't want to be a part of a bigger thing because they want control. This is why when they created the Constitution, they knew that they were dealing with a lot of people in what I'll say the state governments, these cabals, that didn't want to surrender and give up their power. They wanted their own control. They did not care about what was best for the people. They only cared about what served them and their power base and to how they could grow it. This is bad. I mean, these types of things are where people aren't being served. So when we look at the Constitution and this concept of admitting states into the Union, we have to make sure that those people can be properly served. Technically, when you look at some states throughout the world that exist, like Somalia and some of these other states, where if it wasn't for the oil barons that actually control the people there, and so the question is, why is it that these families, these monarchies, like in Saudi Arabia and so forth, why is it that they've done this? In other words, the land right there, the only reason that the people are able to survive is because the king is being nice and noble and feeding them. And they know that they have to do these things or they will revolt. What would end up happening is, and if the people, because when you have a state that is so delicately situated regarding its ability to self-sustain itself, in other words, it's a one-trick pony. It's only oil that keeps people out there in that desert. If that oil wasn't there, where would these nations be today? They wouldn't even be able to protect their own boundaries because they wouldn't have any money and they would be completely vulnerable. But now that they were able to take what America found, because we got to remember, and Ayn Rand actually talked about this, and I'm going down this path, and I've only read Vermont. I'm in a rat hole, so let me back out. The reality is any and all states can join the Union, but there is a process that they need to make sure that they don't become a burden and that they're not they're capable of sustaining themselves. So that's one of the reasons why they wanted to make sure that the territories grew to a certain point to have a tax base and so forth. Sometimes I want to get into the philosophical sides of everything, and that's a huge mistake of mine, so forgive me. So getting back to this, the final part of Article 4, Section 3, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed. This is the admitting of the states into the Union. After they can make these needful rules and they can do these things, the federal government can make the needful rules and regulations respecting the territory. The territory. Once it becomes a state, here's the clause. Nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state, the state joining the Union, or the other states that are already in the Union. So in other words, there's no way that the federal government could create an advantage for themselves or advantages for other states. Every state comes in with equal footing. So getting back to that Vermont Enabling Act, this is what it says, that Vermont should be admitted a member of the United States, and be it enacted the Senate of the House and Senate of the United States in Congress assembled and hereby enacted and declared that on this day of March, the 4th day of March, 1791, the said state by the name of the state of Vermont shall be received and admitted to this Union as a new and entire member of the United States of America. Now, here's the interesting thing. an entire member. They didn't actually use equal footing. An entire member means it is a state like every other state. There are no diminishments. It will be treated equally like every other state in the union. Now, actually, when did they actually get into using this concept or this language or vernacular of saying, hey, we want to use the words equal footing to make sure that that actually states the same? Or I should say, by using the words equal footing, that actually clearly states a doctrine that is that really clarifies this. So when you look at the Kentucky Enabling Act, because they were the next state to join the union, they didn't, I don't see anywhere in here where they say equal footing. And the reason why is because these two states, during the Constitutional Convention process, were ready to join, and they were just waiting to be able to join Continental Congress when Continental Congress was trying to figure out how to admit them. They didn't know how to do it and how Virginia was going to do it. And actually, the concept under the Continental Congress was that Kentucky would actually become a part of Virginia and Vermont would become a part of New Hampshire. But instead, the Constitution actually said, no, those territories will be admitted as new states to ensure that the growth of the Union will continue without states playing these power grabs, growing themselves and so forth. So in other words, the size and state of the state, the size, boundaries, and so forth of that state is not going to change. So when we look at Tennessee, now Tennessee was a breakoff from, do I have Tennessee? Yeah, I do have Tennessee. So let me take a quick glance while I'm talking. Tennessee was the third state to join the Union, and it was a breakoff from the North Carolina. And so is there anything in here that uses the equal footing doctrine? Because at this point in time, they still haven't actually, they had not used equal footing in Tennessee or in Vermont, or in Kentucky and Vermont. Here it is in Tennessee. Be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States and Congress assembled, that the whole of the territory ceded to the United States by the state of North Carolina shall be one state, this is the state of Tennessee, and that the same is hereby declared to be one of the United States of America on equal footing with the original states in all respects, whatever, by the name and title of, or by the name and title, the state of Tennessee. So that's the proper state naming of states in the Union. So when we look at, because we look at how they change their names to a corporate name, and they're using the exact same name. So anyway, the whole point is that the language for equal footing was not injected into the very first two, just due to the fact that they were already on their way to becoming states in the Union. So on Monday, I'll be going further into the concept of the equal footing doctrine so that we can get through these enabling acts. So this is part one of enabling acts under the U.S. Constitution, and Monday will be part two. So this way you have a firm grip on how this happens. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.